KALW.
It's very ominous. It's coming from north.
It comes from the north.
We're going to get to the bottom of a new Bay Area mystery sound.
Someone knows though, right?
Yeah, someone knows for sure. That's loud right. As f***. Yeah. So we're on Mitchman. Yeah, we heard out there on Mitchman, but we still don't know. We're asking too.
There's a new noise on the north side of San Francisco. We'll investigate. Then UC Berkeley's journalism school has a new dean that's promising change.
And we have to lower the cost of tuition at the journalism school because it's out of sync with the entry-level salaries in journalism.
And we get an unexpected answer to the question, who are the most influential Latinos in the Bay Area?
Power actually lies amongst the grassroots. Amongst everyday people.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Recently, reporter Nicholas Harder was in his neighborhood in San Francisco's Richmond District when he heard an eerie hum floating through the air. It was loud enough to catch his attention, the attention of his roommate, and his entire neighborhood. He hopped on his bike and journeyed out with his recorder to discover why the north side of the city is suddenly being bathed in mysterious ethereal tones. Here's Nick.
It's a windy summer day in the city. I'm working from home at my place in the Richmond District when my roommate, Kelsey Alonzo, comes in my room and asks me, "Do you hear that?" "Hear what?" I ask her. She walks me over to a window at the front of the house and points out.
It's very ominous.
There's this strange hum floating over the city. Maybe you can't tell in the recording, but it's loud, like it's in the air. Kelsey and I figure it must be ringing through the whole neighborhood.
It's coming from north.
It comes from the north.
Obviously, I have to hop on my bike and go chase it down.
Ooh, just got a blast of it. It's fainter now that I'm not on the third story of a house. Okay, I'm going up 22nd now.
It's coming from the north, so I head up 22nd Avenue to Lake Street at the top of the neighborhood and listen again. I'm trying to guess what it is, and it's summer during Corona, right? So I'm thinking maybe it's like a group of teenagers having some sort of weird meditation bowl party or something.
I bet you they're celebrating, doing some kind of ceremony or something. Wild guess.
My part of the neighborhood ends in this gorge, Lobos Valley, and the humming is coming from across the gorge, down by where Baker Beach is. So I scoot down there and check it out.
Okay, so I just got my first look at the entire length of the beach. And I hate to see that. I don't see any high school seniors sitting in a circle with some meditation bowls. It seems to be coming from the Golden Gate Bridge, which is at the far end of the beach, past it actually.
I bike through the Presidio and end up at a viewpoint right above the Golden Gate. It's windy, as you can hear, but even with the trees blowing, the sound is so loud, it feels like it's reverberating through me. Below me, there's this employee parking lot for bridge workers and a gated fence that leads back into some more buildings. I spot a bunch of guys in overalls and gear going in and out of this gate. I'm thinking one of them might know what's going on.
How's it going, man? Good. Hey, I'm trying to figure out why the bridge makes that noise.
Lucky for me, I seem to have caught them right as they're switching shifts, and a bridge electrician confirms that the noise is coming from the bridge, but he doesn't know what's causing it.
I was wondering the same thing. I'm.
Oh, really?
My guess is it has to do with the new railings they installed, but that's just a guess. I couldn't tell you for sure, man.
All right.
Sorry.
I talked to a few more iron workers, and surprise, surprise, they don't know either.
Someone knows though, right?
Yeah, someone knows for sure. That's loud right. As f***. Yeah. So we're on Mitchman. Yeah, we heard out there on Mitchman, but we still don't know. We're asking too.
I end up in the administration building by the South Toll Booths, which you've probably driven through. There I meet a young man with curly black hair, bright blue eyes, and a matching blue collared shirt.
My name is Paolo Kozlich-Schwartz. I'm a spokesperson for the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District.
Paolo has all the answers. It is because of the new railing that they installed on the west side of the center of the bridge. The bridge makes that noise as the wind passes through the new rails.
Almost like a wind chime. It was absolutely harmonic and musical. Largely, it had been a very localized, low-level harmonic resonance. And then Friday is when we saw sort of the perfect storm of conditions to create the louder sound that people were tweeting and recording and commenting about online.
I ask Paolo if the rails are still under construction, and he says they are. So I ask him if it's going to get louder, because when it gets going, I can already hear it from my house on 25th and Geary, like 2 miles away. Paolo says he doesn't know.
We did scale model testing. We engaged the world's foremost experts on bridge aerodynamics. But, you know, it's a limit of the testing and the analysis that we did not know that it would the sound would be quite so audible.
You see, the new rails are part of a larger wind retrofit the bridge has been going through. They're retrofitting to install a suicide prevention net underneath the bridge. That heavy-duty net, necessary as it is going to act like a sail, just catching tons of wind under the bridge. And if the bridge gets too wind-resistant as a result of this net, it can start wobbling and pull itself apart. So these new aerodynamic rails are meant to compensate for the net. They're meant to keep the bridge structurally sound, and the acoustic effect, as Paolo calls it, is actually just a byproduct of the new, more aerodynamic design.
We expect it will only happen in very rare and specific circumstances when the wind is approaching the bridge from a very specific direction at very high speeds.
Not only that, but it's possible that as they complete the retrofit, this new sound could disappear. It might just be an ephemeral phenomenon, not a permanent addition. Either way, Paolo says we should not expect to hear it often.
This is not something you'll be going to bed hearing. This is not something you'll be waking up to in the morning. It will only really happen on those rare days when the stars align to create this new sound.
But for now, if you're visiting the Golden Gate Bridge and the wind is blowing real hard and from just the right angle, you might just be lucky enough to hear her sing. In San Francisco, I'm Nicholas Harder for Cross Currents.
Nick originally recorded that story for his podcast, Out of Trouble. Look for it on your podcast player to hear a longer version and more of his intriguing stories. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism has new leadership. Geeta Anand is the new interim dean, the first woman to be in that position. Anand comes after the resignation of Ed Wasserman, who was dean for 7 years. And she comes in the midst of a major shakeup over diversity at the school. Recently, the school's chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists voiced concerns about what it sees as the school's lack of diversity and poor handling of racial inequality issues. Chapter members drafted 17 action items for the school to work on, and 5 working groups are taking them on. What's happening at Berkeley reflects a broader conversation around the lack of diversity in journalism schools and newsrooms. I talked to Interim Dean Anand to ask what the working groups are doing. And a quick note of disclosure, KALW does partner with the school to air stories reported by its students.
They're looking at things like diversifying the student body, diversifying the faculty. They're looking at external facing activities, how we can be more supportive and reflective of the diversity of the country in just the events we have at the school, the speakers we invite. They're looking at support for students, like financial aid and support for students to make sure that the Black students we recruit here and other students, other first generation students that can afford to actually come and live in the Bay Area. So we're casting a wide, wide net and looking very, very broadly at the underlying issues that are sort of part of the NABJ demands, but that also underlie them.
Right. What is the makeup of the student body in terms of students of color? Do they tend to go into journalism schools? I know one thing I do a lot in my community, I'm from Sudan and I talk to African communities as well, other communities from around the continent who feel, you know, media narratives about us, about Africa overall, are just so poor. So I talk to people about journalism and entering journalism schools to create your own narrative. But one of the things I hear back is, you know, it's either I can't afford it, or we don't see a lot of people of color in media overall, so I'm not sure I'll find a job. They say to me, we feel it's an unsafe time to be a journalist. And so, you know, what's the makeup of the student body, and what can be done to attract more young people of color into journalism in these times?
I mean, our student body is quite diverse, but journalism is not diverse. Because students from underprivileged backgrounds cannot afford to be journalists for the most part. It's really, really difficult to conceive of spending the money to go to journalism school, working a fewer hours so you can go to journalism school, and then conceiving of a way of paying back the money in those early years and for any loans you've taken in entry-level jobs, which, as you know, don't pay very well in journalism. So we lose a lot of students to other professions in those early years. What I think should be done is we have to raise money, and we are raising money immediately, to fund more scholarships for Black students and other people of color and people from underprivileged backgrounds. And we also have to lower the cost of tuition at the journalism school in general, because it's out of sync with the entry level salaries in journalism. That would make it, you know, much more. I mean, that would just open up journalism to just more diversity. And then, of course, we should have a more diverse faculty. That will make a huge, huge difference, because it's so important to see yourself reflected in some of the instructors around you. But I think the finances and the economics are a really big part of it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think a journalism school's role is in the broader media industry and in creating a diverse media landscape? So people come in to the school, they graduate. What kinds of collaborations or partnerships can happen to make sure your graduates go out into the world and find work in media?
I think it's really important for journalism schools to offer an apprenticeship model. I think it's really important to teach, but also to work alongside your students in a collaborative way, enabling them to publish. And that's what I'm really hoping we will do more of in the journalism school in the years ahead. We have that as a model. The investigative reporting program has for years had students involved in projects. But I think that we really should expand that. And we did expand that this past spring, where we pivoted as a school and turned ourselves into a newsroom covering COVID. 20 instructors were team leaders in that effort. 80 students participated. 38 of them or so have been published in the New York Times, 19 of them students of color. Another 36 were published in a wide variety of other publications, from KQED to the LA Times to the Desert Sun. More than half of those students of color. So I think publishing and creating opportunities for students to learn and to be published while they're in school is critical.
You know, when a news organization has no people of color, or the country's newsrooms have these abysmal numbers of journalists of color, one thing they say that I've heard is, well, where are they? Well, we can't find them. I've heard that from some leaders of some newsrooms. And that's when one thinks, well, is this about the pipeline or too few people of color entering journalism schools? This question of the pipeline, what do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's a chicken and egg thing too. So I think that publications are, that just is not excuse enough that you can't find them. I think you just have to look further away. You have to maybe change your criterion for accepting applications. You have to just look in historically disenfranchised communities and in schools that serve them, in community colleges that serve them. So you have to look further. But I also agree that it's a pipeline issue. And I think it's a partly that because it's just so economically difficult to become a journalist. It just, for people who actually get an education who are from disenfranchised communities, if you get that education and you have large families to support who need you to earn the best income you can. So it's really difficult then to consider an entry-level job in journalism at that salary, because you're often trying to uplift like several generations on your shoulders.
A lot of us, I think, in journalism who've been to these conferences year after year after year for many, many years, there's always, you know, the diversity panel, the diversity conversation. It feels like it's a conversation that we've been having for so long. But a lot of people are optimistic about this moment. Why are you optimistic this time that this will mean real change?
I guess because I'm a student of history. So we've been pushing for changes like this for 30 years. I've also seen changes happen. Like as a college student, we were protesting against apartheid, taking over the president's office, building a shanty town on the green. And several years later, the college actually divested from companies doing business in South Africa. So I've participated in protests and I've seen change results. So I have great faith in the ability of activism to press organizations to change substantively. Great faith in just the power of social dynamics to bring about institutional change. Will everything get solved? No. Will it all get solved immediately? No. But it will lead us to be able to make changes that would have taken decades in any other time. So I'm optimistic for that reason.
Geeta Anand is the new interim dean at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. You can hear the rest of my conversation with her at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Fighting for representation and equity is something the Bay Area is known for, which brings us to our next piece from Hey Area, our project where you ask the questions and we go out to find the answers. Listener Monserrat Gonzalez wanted to know, who are the most influential Latinos in the Bay Area? KALW's Porfirio Rangel has the answer.
Well, if we're up to me, I'd say Carlos Santana. His music is fun to dance to, but I felt like I needed a more sophisticated answer. So I went back to school to meet with my former professor, Jason Ferreira. He's the chair of the Department of Race and Resistance Studies at SF State.
I'm going to say Eric Quesada.
Professor Ferreira told me Quesada was an activist for housing and immigration rights in the Mission District. He helped create the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition in the late 1990s.
He was also the executive director of Dolores Street Community Services in the Mission District, providing housing to homeless and the real vulnerable in the community.
Quesada was diagnosed with cancer in 2004, but continued his work as an activist. In 2008, he decided to run for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors for District 9. Here he is, campaigning.
I fought and I fight to preserve and expand all that's right, but at risk in our district.
Quesada lost that race. He continued to stand up for economic and social justice, but by 2011, the cancer took his life. He was just 45 years old. Professor Ferreira says he remains an influence.
One thing to take away from the example of Eric Quesada and the things that he dedicated his life to is to recognize that power actually lies amongst the grassroots.
That was an archive piece from our project, Hey Area, where you ask the questions and we find the answers. Find more at klw.org/heyarea. And before we go, here's some new music from a local band. This is the Oakland-based band California Honey Drops, and this song is from their new EP called Just One More and Then Some.
There used to be a bird that sang by my window after it rained. Skies would clear, a sweet song I'd hear, music all in.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Christopher Agusa, Imran Ali Malik, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Babette Thomas. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. The news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.